Well, hello, everybody. It is January 31st, and Steph's here with me. Hey, Steph.
Howdy. Hi.
And we're going to have a cool show today because we're interviewing Jess Phoenix, and she's a geologist. A geologist and a Democrat, and she's running against Republican Steve Knight. He's an incumbent in California's 25th congressional district, and she's a volcanologist, and she's a scientist, a geologist. We're going to let her explain all that, but I mean, aren't you excited? This is so cool.
I love it because, okay, first of all, you say volcanologist, but I sort of hear volcanologist.
But that's what she is.
I know, but as a Trekkie, I go Vulcan and Vulcan. But anyway, it's great. Yes, I'm very excited about Jess. She's one of those people who has me, who fills me with hope because we need her. We need people like her because we have got to change the state of affairs.
Yeah. Yes, we absolutely do. But I saw an article that said VUL, volcanologist. So we're going to have to talk to her about that. And guess what? She's right here. Hey, Jess.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Steph. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi.
Thank you both for having me on. This is awesome. And I can clear up that Vulcan thing. So in Italy, it's still Vulcan with a U because, you know, Vulcan the god is where the name came from. I mean, of course, the Romans stole that from the Greeks. It was Hephaestus with the Greeks. And then the Romans said, hey, we're going to call him Vulcan, same guy. And they thought he lived in volcanoes because volcanoes make loud booming noises, even if they're not actively erupting. If you look into a lava lake, it sounds like metal hitting metal. So it kind of makes sense. They thought it was a big god with a, you know, banging horseshoes or something out there with a hammer. So yeah, it's Vulcan in Italy and the rest of the world, pretty much it's Vulcan with an O. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the fact that I do like Star Trek and am a certifiable geek, it works out well either way.
Yep. My mother is a major Star Trek fan, and so is my boyfriend, the producer, Bob Seska. So you're in good company. And Steph, evidently you are too.
Yes, I take it from my father. He raised us right.
Well, I got to say that I was not, I didn't get into Star Trek as a little girl when my mother was insanely in love with it. And I remember when I was around 8 years old, my mom was a single mom and we had a roommate named Phyllis, and Phyllis was also a Trekkie. So I remember there was this one day they took my TV out of my bedroom, my little black and white, and they had our regular TV in the living room. One of them was playing Star Trek and one of them was playing something else because they just could not miss Star Trek. So it was like two televisions were going on just so they could watch Star Trek. It was like, oh my God. But yeah, they're total Trekkies. So I'm surrounded by Trekkies.
Eventually you too will be part of it. It's yes. Just a matter of time.
Oh my God. Okay. So let me just read some of your, some stuff about you. I know that you are in the Explorers Club, so explain what that is.
Okay, so it is a group for people who do science, well, exploration in the name of science. Mm-hmm. So it used to be one of those kind of old white guy hunting and colonialism clubs. Mm-hmm. So it was founded in 1904, and that was sort of the whole mystique of it was they had a lot of taxidermy, and you know, it was like it was sort of the stuff that we don't do now. But it was really a neat thing because it was sort of a counterpart to the Royal Geographical Society in England, which kind of helped finance and helped spur on a lot of the neat discoveries and accomplishments that people made when they were exploring different parts of the world, like Antarctica, etc. Cool. So the Explorers Club was the U.S. version of that. And we have among our membership Teddy Roosevelt, Edmund Hillary, Tenzing Norgay, Jane Goodall, Sally Ride. You know, it's a pretty cool group of people.
Cameron
and Neil Armstrong.
Aldrin. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, and you know, they started allowing women women at the urging of Carl Sagan, among others, in 1981. And yes, because Carl Sagan rocks.
Yes.
And and so they really shifted focus because, you know, old white guys hunting things had a limited shelf life. And now the focus of the club is about promoting exploration in the name of science. And so you have to, I'm a fellow in the club, which means that you have to have contributed to the body of scientific knowledge. You can be a member if you've gone on expeditions that do science, but and you can be an associate if you just really like exploration and you want to, you know, be part of it. But you have to have to be a fellow, you've got to have published things and contributed overall to science. So they also have a really cool student program, which I am really a big advocate of because I want to see more young people getting into scientific exploration and field science. So it's sort of neat because you think that there's no group of people who are the same amount of crazy, but apparently there is a group, and it's a really neat place because, you know, you may think, okay, well, I'm working on volcanoes, that's pretty cool, and then you hear, oh, somebody went to the bottom of the ocean, or, you know, and studied microbes in Antarctica for 6 months, and you're like, okay, wow, you know, like they're, yeah, they're amazing. So it really keeps you from getting any sort of ego because everybody else in the club is pretty awesome.
Wow.
Can I, you know what, I think that's fascinating, and I've done some exploring just as somebody who enjoys travel and you know, the beauty of being outdoors and in a variety of different places and on a few different continents. But one of the things I've always noticed about even like the kids' science trips, right? Like my young kids go on, there's a science trip. It's their first sleepaway, and it's in the third grade, and they do it again in the fourth grade, and it unifies people. Mm-hmm. Because you're out in my experience and in the experience of my children, they're outdoors, they're working together toward, you know, whether it's on an experiment or trying to make a discovery, but it's this unifying sort of super organic because you're outside and you're in the elements, and it's a very special experience. And I think it doesn't matter who you are. If you're somebody with, you know, like a working brain and you want to be there, I really do believe there's this overarching sort of theme of unification and respect. And it's not just respect for your fellow scientists, but for our planet and for whatever it is, whether it's the microbes you're researching or the bottom of the ocean that you're on. Do you agree with that? I mean, that's always sort of been my take on it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's exactly it. That's why with the nonprofit that I founded, it was really, it's called Blueprint Earth. And the whole premise of it is that we need to be protecting Earth's environments. And the only way to do that is if we understand how they work as systems. So we need to be integrating geology and biology and hydrology and atmosphere and engineering. They all need to work together because, you know, nothing exists in a vacuum, particularly mm-hmm. not in an environment. So I wanted to make sure, though, that students were getting the opportunity to come out and experience field research because there's this growing trend towards remote sensing. So using satellites and other equipment to make observations and not actually have to have boots on the ground. And mm-hmm. remote sensing is really important, and it's a really, really great tool for helping to protect scientists' lives because, you know, if you don't have to go right up next to a volcano, you probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
but field science is really it's really how we understand the world around us in a more intimate way, and mm-hmm. having to work in groups and discuss things with people who have different backgrounds, different knowledge of the subjects than you do is a really good way to think about how we're going to tackle big picture problems like those we see in the 21st century, like climate change. Mm-hmm. So if mm-hmm. we want a generation of scientists who know how to work together to solve problems, then we need to give them the opportunity to do that in the real world. And so that's what I've been working for. And you know, I think that groups that advocate, you know, getting out into the world in an effort to promote research and discovery, I mean, that's just phenomenal, and we should have more of them.
So let me, before I ask you what made you decide to run, tell us a little bit more about Blueprint Earth, when you started it, and you know, any information that you haven't already given us.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So we, my husband Carlos, we had seen a need for an organization that addressed environments as a whole. And we lived in Australia for a while. And while we were over there, you know, we had talked about where could we do this? Where could we have an organization that gives research opportunities to students while also doing real world research that would matter? And when we moved back to the United States, it was like, okay, this is perfect. This is LA. I mean, LA has so many students from so many different backgrounds who would love the chance to get out and do scientific field work, that and also has so many good schools with great professors and a lot of people in industry who could help us do this research. So we started it in August of 2013, and we sent our first batch of students out to the Mojave Desert here in Southern California in the spring of 2014, and we've been doing it ever since. So we regularly send out groups of anywhere to 22 people, and they're teams of students working with supervisory scientists, and we're cataloging everything in a square kilometer of the Mojave Desert. And it's just our first environment. The plan is to move on to the tundra and then the grasslands and do increasingly more complicated biomes until we've got the seven major ones done. And then we really hope that the techniques that we use will be able to be ported to people all around the world so they can study specific environments and catalog everything in them, see how it's all connected. And then, you know, when you really understand something in science, you can reproduce it. So our end goal is to be able to create functional environments and keep the knowledge of what's in these environments, kind of like they're doing with the Global Seed Vault, except we're doing it on an environmental scale.
That's really cool.
Super cool.
Wow, it's so impressive. And I'm just like, I don't even know what to say to that. That's so impressive. It's like wonderful that you're doing this.
Well, you know, it's like there's a need, and so you got to go and fill the need. And
right.
You know, I mean, if we want to address humanitarian issues like deforestation, we need to know everything that goes back into a healthy forest. If we want to clean up after mining projects, I mean, people still want their computers and their smartphones. So we still need to extract some natural resources until we can synthesize them or something ourselves. So we need to make sure that we're doing the best possible job of rehabilitating these areas where we're doing natural resources work. And then someday when we go to space, when we're in space, but when we go to the moon or Mars and we want to have people there for a sustained amount of time, we need to have a way to optimize an environment to take the ingredients that we need basically with us. And we can only do that if we know everything from the microbes to the clouds.
Wow. That's so cool.
It is so cool. And you know what? It's extremely complicated, I'm sure. To go out there and study, you know, a biome, and there are seven of them now. I'm taking notes. I'm going to have to do a little research after this. But Jess, tell me, I mean, but at the same time, it's so basic for anybody that can look around and, you know, being in California and we have these, you know, torrential downpours at some, you know, that are uncharacteristic of the time of year. And then we have unbelievable drought and these wildfires that are, you know, wiping out.
Yeah, and firestorms. You
know, firestorms and then mudslides because after the firestorm, it takes all of the earth with it and wipes out Montecito. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I mean about it being basic. So I want to know, when you're elected to Congress, how are you going to insert yourself, because it's dire. We know this. Kimberly and I know this. You know this. How are you going to get in there and make this an issue that should be dealt with immediately and bring people into the fold with you?
Well, I think that one advantage that I have is that I'm not afraid to speak my mind. anybody who follows me on Twitter can see that. And I think that comes from working in geology. I mean, we're not, you know, in some cushy office suite. Like, I mean, I have been in so many situations where it's do or die, essentially. And so, you know, if something really matters, I'm very, very okay with being a fierce advocate for it. And I believe that our environment is one of the largest, if not the most critical issue of our time, because without a healthy environment, we can't live healthy, fulfilling lives. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a good example is that one of the Trump nominees for an environmental position is now back again. The one who, you know, doesn't understand how much of, you know, excess heat goes into the oceans, or thinks that carbon dioxide can't be, you know, at all bad for us because we're made of carbon. That's the sort of thing that, you know, I mean, Sheldon Whitehouse did a great job of calling her out, the senator. Yes. He called her out on that. But, you know, being there and being a scientist, one thing I think that is going to be very, very true is that in any sort of instance where someone goes, well, I'm not a scientist, but I will be the first to jump up and say, well, I am a scientist and,
and you know, you, madam, are unqualified if this is what you believe, you know, something needs to be done.
Exactly. And there's no reason to pull punches at this point because this stuff is so critical.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've had, we're at a point now where facts are just being slaughtered. Yeah. They are not treated with any sort of respect or deference, and objectivity has been thrown out the window in favor of partisanship and in favor of playing to your big wealthy donor base. And I don't find that acceptable. And I think that's why getting in a new crop of non-career politicians, of people who have jobs in the real world, you know, that outside of politics, and who want to go back to those jobs someday, people who see this as a problem that needs solving, I think those are the people that I will be able to work with very well, because we all understand the sense of urgency that exists around not just the climate, but, you know, other issues of the time, like gun violence and the opioid epidemic. And, you know, these are things that science can help us tackle.
What made you decide to run? When did you announce your candidacy? So, and what was the big thing that you're like, I'm just going to run now. I'm going to run for office.
Well, it's funny because I kept thinking that the idea first occurred to me in January. And then I was recently, I went back and looked at a post in that I made in Pantsuit Nation, the secret Facebook group, the day of the election. And I said, hey, I want help, you know, exploring a run for office. But of course, I didn't know at all which office or anything. And it sort of was just an idea. And then it, you know, it quickly devolved into, oh, gosh, what are we doing now? now that Trump is going to be president. But then in January, I gave a talk at the Natural History Museum here in Los Angeles. And some friends of mine who had twin 4-year-old boys, they're obviously older now, but they came up to me, and my talk was just on volcanoes and the research that I do. And they came up and they said, you know, we're really afraid for the world that our boys are going to grow up in. We want them to know, you know, what facts are and objectivity is. And, you know, we want them to have good science educations in, you know, via public school. And we're really afraid that's not going to be an option. And they said, we wish that people like you were running things. And it sort of was like a small hint. And then some other scientist folks were there and they came up to me and said, you know, we really need scientists in office. We need scientists to run. And I kind of went, oh, I'm a scientist. Why won't I run? Yeah. And it became more of a, well, maybe I should do this. And, you know, from there, I reached out to several groups who had information for candidates about how to run and everything. And I heard back from 314 Action, which is the group that's invested in helping scientists run for office. And they provided me with a lot of early information and direction. And so I was able to start a campaign. I officially announced April 17th. And so I've been in the race for like 10 months now, I think. And it's a really, really, really long race. Everybody said, isn't that early? But at this point, there is no business as usual anymore. Everything is different. And so we have, you know, this is like nothing anyone has ever seen in terms of, you know, the number of people running, the depth of the professions of people who are running. And, you know, it's really encouraging. But at the same time, it is a long slog.
Yeah, but really, I mean, you think about it, I feel like this year, or it's been more than a year now, but since the election, First of all, I've been comfort eating myself into, like, you know, I'm sitting here with my jeans unzipped, if I'm going to tell the truth. But it has, it seemed like forever, yet it's going really quickly.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a panic. You know, I'm friends with Buffy Wicks, who used to work for Barack Obama, and she was a community organizer. She worked for Howard Dean and then Obama, and now she's my neighbor, and she's running for state assembly here in California. And it's just, it's like steamrolling, right?
Uh-huh.
And yet we're still 10 months out. Mm-hmm. And yet, oh my God, is there enough time, right? And here, I'm sure that April seems like forever, but oh my God, we're going to be voting real quick here, or the people of the 25th district are going to be voting really soon for you.
Yeah, in the primary.
And exactly. And so, you know, that it's crazy. It's a long slog, but it's like, oh my God, is there enough time for us to get our S together and make this happen and flip everybody? But Jess, I want to go back. Yeah, and I don't mean to cut you off, but you were just talking about, well, I'm a scientist. Did you ever feel that it was not almost incumbent on you to step up and say, you know what? I owe it to America to lend my knowledge and my experience to this crumbling democracy?
Yeah, a bit. And I think it's, you know, my whole life I've kind of thought that at some point I would need to do something, not just for science, but like for the greater good. It's just,
yes.
It's always been there. And it could be because my parents were both in the FBI. And, you know, I mean, I had other relatives who were, you know, involved in different ways in, you know, a grandfather who was in the reserves, that sort of thing. So, you know, it's maybe something that's been at the back of my brain, but I didn't think it would take the form of running for Congress. But I definitely felt compelled to do so. And when it's been difficult, when it's been, you know, when we're really in the blood and the mud, you know, without it actually being real blood or mud, my husband reminds me that I would probably be more upset if I hadn't run, because I would be thinking, what if, what if, what if? And at
yep.
least now I know that I'm able to get the message out to people that, yes, there are scientists who are willing to take on public policy in a really, really in-depth way and stand up and communicate and not be distant from the public. And I think historically scientists have been not so great at communicating to the public about what we do. And it's something that people have been trying hard to change, especially over the last couple of decades. But we need science to not only be accessible, but needs to be an everyday part of our lives. Mm-hmm. And we need to acknowledge science for all good that it does for society. And, you know, about how everybody would be wandering around, you know, crippled by polio still if we hadn't had
right.
scientific research.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one example. But there are so many other areas of every single part of our lives that are improved by science. And we need scientists to serve as ambassadors to the public. And we need scientists in our government. And it's just, it's beyond time. So here I am.
So you yeah. say that you want to bring Star Trek values to Congress. So explain what you mean by that. I mean, I think I know where you're going, but it's a great idea.
Yeah, and not everybody is a Star Trek fan, so it is good to explain to them. Because people want to know. So what the world of Star Trek is in the future. It's set in the future, and in that future, you have things like, you know, people know the Vulcans for saying live long and prosper. And so that's one set of values right there. But if you just look at what you think of when you think of Star Trek, you think of aliens working with people. And, you know, you had women as integral parts of the crew. And in the new Star Trek Discovery show, you actually have a gay couple who are crew members and who they make no secret about their relationships. There's straight kisses, gay kisses. Like it's just part of life on the ship. And, you know, I think it really plays into the larger principle that, you know, Gene Roddenberry had and that they set out in Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry, of course, is the creator. And that was infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And that to me is just beautiful.
Beautiful.
It's science, and yeah. it's science, and it's art, and it's poetry all at once. And I think that is the best way, wow. one of the best ways I've heard of encapsulating our world is just that it is infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And,
right.
you know, if we get to a point like in, yeah. And not just tolerance, but acceptance and, you know, acknowledgement. And I think if we really want to create a society where we are equitable, where people have, you know, don't have unfair barriers to access, whether that's career access or healthcare access or just being treated right. I think if we want to work towards that, the model of Star Trek, where they've eliminated hunger and poverty and want and war, I think that is a pretty good model to follow and to aspire to. So that those are the sort of values I'm talking about. I mean, if we want to talk about Klingons and Kirk fighting the Gorn and all that, like, you know, that's a whole different thing. But and that's the thing is that we, you know, as a species, we're really good at using the arts, whether it's TV or movies or music or painting or sculpture or photography. We use the arts to help us interpret the facts of the world around us. So arts and science go hand in hand. And you know, you can't have one without the other without kind of devolving into something that is really not that beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so I think that having shows like Star Trek, which has endured for more than 50 years as kind of a cultural touchstone.
I just want to add that Jess is living in a rural area. So some of our Wi-Fi has been kind of sketchy. So apologize for all of that. But I want to make sure everybody knows where to follow Jess. So Jess, take it away. Tell everybody, you know, how they can donate, finding you online in your various places.
Okay, so that this has been fantastic. Thank you both so much. And
thank you, Jess.
So I would be really excited if people want to follow me on Twitter. I am there. My username is JessPhoenix2018, so 2018. You can also find me on Facebook. The page is just Jess Phoenix. It has a picture of me in blazer and a white shirt. So that's not my personal page. It's the campaign one. And then you can also find me on Instagram. It's JessPhoenix2018 on there as well. And then people can visit my website, which is Jess2018.com. And if you want to skip all of that and just contribute, which would be amazing because we really need to have a great amount of small dollar donations to push back against those wealthy big corporate PACs that the Republicans have. It's Jess2018.com/give.
There
so
you
really
go.
Easy.
Woo-hoo.
Yes.
Well,
again, sorry for the technical difficulties. It's weird. I've never had problems like this, and I've done plenty of podcasts from my house. So I don't know. Maybe it's just maybe it was the super blue blood moon. I'm going to blame that.
Maybe. I think so. Well, thank you, Jess. And, you know, sorry for the technological stuff, but we got a lot of really good stuff, and I'm glad that you had the opportunity to tell your tale, and we're going to be supporting you.
Ah, thank you both so much.
I just clicked the green donate button, Jess.
thank you so much. That's awesome. And yeah, if you tell your friends and they tell their friends, like, that's how we do grassroots.
Exactly.
You know, that's how we make it happen.
We're gonna make it
that's
happen.
Right.
All right.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you,
Jess, for doing what you're doing. We need you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Take care.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Wow. That was interesting. Unfortunately, you know, with the Wi-Fi situation, I had some more questions for her, but I think we got some really good information out of her, and she's such a fascinating person, and I'm so glad that she's running.
I am too. You know what I loved? She said, you know, science, and she kept saying geek and blah, blah, blah. She is so well-spoken and so approachable that she is going to make just so much positive change just by virtue of who she is and the way she interacts with people and the way she made talking about the seven biomes and microbe study sound interesting. Like, I'm fascinated by it, but she's going to be a force. We're going to be treated to some long Jess Phoenix influence.
Yeah, I hope so, because
coming up here soon. Yeah,
I didn't get the opportunity to ask her about who she was running against, but it's a Republican man. That's pretty much all you need to know at this point in the
Steve
game anyway.
Knight.
Oh my God. And you know, but just to change the subject a little bit, I still haven't even had a chance to see your video. I did retweet you last night. But
I know, but I it's haggard. But anyway, thanks.
Oh, well, I want to watch it. I wanted to make one, but as you know, we're in the middle of a move. So I've been, you know, packing and trying to organize, you know, shipping cars and getting movers estimates, and just took my car in today for its final service in California. And of course I have to get new brake pads. So that's $500. So it'd be really awesome if people wanted to support the show.
Yes.
Help me pay.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm just like, what did you think of the State of the Union? I just got to get your opinion on this.
I boycotted that shit. Are you kidding me?
Well, I watched it because I feel like it's history in the making, and that I wanted to be prepared to be able to talk about it without just listening to other people's talking
points. I watched
points.
Some highlights. I'm not going to lie. But I was at a NARAL California event last night watching the four Democratic gubernatorial candidates answer questions about women's reproductive health. Huh. And I sat in the front row and I hooted and I hollered and I made eye contact with all of them. And it was very, very interesting. And I felt like that was a good use of my time, because I don't know that I could have sat there for the State of the Union. So instead, when I got home, I watched highlights. And, you know, nothing sickens me more than knowing that our commander in chief applauded himself for however long he was up there. He's a moron who read from a teleprompter, mm-hmm. and from all I could tell, all of the, you know, the commentary afterwards was saying it was boring. It was, mm-hmm. you know, it was really slow in the beginning, very forgettable. Mm-hmm. But then one clip I did catch was when he showed the family of someone who was murdered by an MS-13. So what that said to me is that, oh, look, I'm such a racist, mm-hmm. and I'm so, divisive, whatever, you know, by pronunciation, you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pit the blacks against the browns. Yay, America.
Yeah.
And to that I say, you know, F off. It was funny because my Share the Dream video, mm-hmm. I said my dream for the country is that I want to end racism now.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very real and it's very alive, and that division, you know, separating people and picking people apart and putting them into packs rather than unifying them, like, he couldn't be further apart from the infinite diversity and infinite combinations that Jess wants to bring to the to the table.
Exactly.
And he sickens me. And so I had a donut this morning, and then I said to myself, this is going to end soon, because it has to end soon, because there are too many of us here, and there is too much good in America for a bozo like this and all of his fake Christian worshiping the money god and buying into racism and being motivated by their racism and by their need for money, which to them equals power. Mm-hmm. I can't take much more of it. Oh, I did finish my video, which was only about 35 seconds in length, but I just said, I'm not, you know, are we going to wait for Mueller? Are we going to wait for Congress? No, we got to take to the streets.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because, and I've been saying this on my Facebook page, and I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but clearly Trump wants to get rid of Mueller. He wants to probably get rid of Rosenstein, however you say his name. And it, obviously it's going to have to do Rosenstein first. Rosenstein. I don't know what his name is.
Right.
Anyway,
I say Stein, you say
let's
potato.
Just say Stein.
It's all good.
Rosenstein. You know, everybody is worried, and it's understandable. I mean, one of my main concerns is, what if, you know, he gets rid of Mueller and then they get a replacement in there who's like a Kremlin agent or something? You know, I mean, like, can that even happen? I don't know. I'm going to say it probably can't. But I think that people are pissed off. And if this does go down, I do think people are going to take to the streets. I don't know what that'll accomplish. But I find it fascinating that, and I don't really know what any of this means, other than to say it's interesting. And I might have said this before, but it was somebody that I talked to outside. It was like somebody that I know. I can't say who it is. They know somebody in intelligence who told them that Trump would be forced out by the GOP, or actually, forced out was the word that they used, that the intelligence said, Trump would be forced out by GOP in March. And that things are moving along much faster than we realize. Just shortly after that, I think it was the same day, there was a gentleman whose name escapes me, but he's a history professor, historian, and he has accurately predicted elections since 1984, including Trump. He said that he believes when Mueller shows us Trump's crimes, that's going to shock the country, and it's going to force basically the GOP to start impeachment proceedings. And then Malcolm Nance, who is also, I think, former intelligence, believes that in March or in the spring, and that's what this guy said. The other guy, the historian, said that GOP is going to start forcing out or starting impeachment in March or the spring. And then Malcolm Nance says in March, we're going to see some big indictments. So mm-hmm. I don't know if GOP is ever going to push impeachment. At this point, they're so complicit.
I have no faith in that.
No, I don't either. But what I do think is that because the FBI is being attacked, I think they're going to, you know, I think there was information today about Jeff Sessions coming out from the, you know what, I read the story so early, but long story short is that there was information about Jeff Sessions and it had to do with this whole obstruction thing. And whoever, I think it was Ale on Twitter who said it. She's really great. If you don't follow her, Ale.
Yes.
I think she broke it down that this information is very strategic on behalf of the intelligence community and the FBI because they're being attacked. They're being attacked by Trump and by the Republicans. So they're releasing all this basically as proof. I guess it was something having to do with emails. All I know is the DOJ got all kinds of information, emails from, you know, Trump's campaign, Sessions, and others. So regarding this whole, you know, Comey firing and all of this. So they're letting this information out so it's public and that it's on the record. It doesn't matter because Republicans are going to paint this as a deep state coup and all of that. But for the people who do appreciate the truth is out there. They're letting it out there. So I don't necessarily think that the GOP is going to go for impeachment. But what I do think is that this March, this spring is going, you know, I mean, if you've noticed, it seems to me that things are accelerating. You know, it's like the amount of freaking, you know, Bob likes to say that, you know, at least he started saying that we had the tennis ball machine of news. Now it's like the fire hose. So it's just mm-hmm. constant breaking news. And I just think that what this is going to do is motivate all of us. Whether we're political, activists, whether we're just political junkies or even people who maybe haven't been paying attention before, all of this information is getting out there and it's going to make people really, 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 engaged. And I hope, and I think that it means the midterms are going to see record turnout. I think we're set up, you know, I mean, I posted that the other day, like I predict that the midterms are going to have, you know, like the highest amount of voters that we've ever seen for midterms. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because, you know, and of course you get the naysayers saying, oh, I don't know, blah, blah, because yes, there's gerrymandering and yes, there's suppression, but take a look at Virginia, take a look at Michigan. We just flipped a district in Michigan. To blue.
Take a look at Alabama.
And Alabama and New Jersey. So I think that while we are going to see some losses with Democrats along the way, and fortunately we've been seeing a lot of wins, I think we're going to see mostly wins. And
I hope so.
Yeah, me too. I mean,
who I want to talk to? Can I just put it out there? I want to talk to Jenny Wilson. She's running for U.S. Senate. For Orrin Hatch's seat.
Oh, wow.
Utah. Okay. She's the real deal. She's like a fifth generation Utah. But she's no flash in the pan. You know, right. She's like, I'm going to run for Senate. No, she's like, she's ready to be a senator. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's like me. When can I run for Senate? but no, she's paid her dues.
Yeah.
I I hear what you're saying, and you know I'm all rainbows and unicorns most of the time. But right now, you know, we talk to people like ourselves. You know, you and I are back and forth. Our friends, the people that we surround ourselves with on the Twitterverse, you know, we're like-minded people. Mm-hmm. And yes, I 100% trust Malcolm Nance, because the dude is former intelligence. The dude was secret ops or whatever you call it. He's connected and he knows. He knows. So yeah, I think March is going to just be that. That's when I'll be able to start the diet, because I have a feeling Trump Jr. is going to be, you know, getting perp walked, and maybe even Jared. Oh my God.
I know.
How exciting would that be? But think of the stuff. Okay, we have information that we have, and maybe there are some secret sources who know some things and they're back channeling that to people like you who are in the know. But think about what Mueller's team
knows. Oh my God,
knows.
I know.
We have so much to be excited about with, you know, Manafort, Gates, Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
Okay?
So it's like they flip. So we've got Manafort, Gates, Flynn, and Papadopoulos who have flipped.
Papadopoulos, right? Okay. So think about what else they know that we don't know. Yeah. That's all really exciting. But here's where I go a little... where I, you know, the unicorn is skipping away from me at this point because I don't know if people care as much as we do. Outside of our circles.
But the thing is that's amazed. Why I say take a look at Virginia. You know, look at what happened in Virginia. When we start doubting and wondering, because I'm right there with you and I get worried. But when you look at a, you know, I mean, they call Virginia purple, and it is. But still, I mean, there's a lot of right wingers who live there. And last year, we saw a record number of women. We saw a trans candidate, mm-hmm. It was like the graphic
blow
from,
them out of the water.
Yeah, like the graphic of who was there and the graphic to replace them. It was like all older white men replaced by mostly women. And so I have, you know, the thing is people don't do things when they're comfortable. The whole nation is uncomfortable. Of course, there's going to be a lot of people who are not paying attention. But, you know, I'm always going to go back to the one benefit of the Bernie versus Hillary argument that was going on was that a lot of people started to pay attention. Bernie brought a lot of young people in general to, you know, just to pay attention to politics. And Hillary brought a lot of women and young women. So, and it's not to say that she didn't bring along young men, but obviously young women were inspired by her run. So, and both of those candidates started, you know, this whole new crop of young people and women deciding to run. You know, I mean, it's like, I'm sick and tired of all the bullshit arguing back and forth. I want to focus on the good that they did. And I think the good that they did was they got things going. You know, they got people interested and talking. And so where we saw a lower turnout, I mean, it's like half the country voted for 2016. I do predict that it's going to be a much better, I mean, God, the 2014 midterm elections were abysmal. I think it was like the worst turnout in 80 years for Democrats, or turnout in general. I think that's going to be different. I think we're going to flip that and we're going to see probably the highest turnout. And it's just because no matter who you are, I mean, like, let me just say, one of my very most embarrassing things to admit is that I like watching The Real Housewives, whether I and the ones that I specifically watch are Beverly Hills, New Jersey, and Orange County. So I'm watching Beverly Hills right now, and a couple of references have been made. They're not big time references, but if you're paying attention, you catch them. Like, for instance, one of the women on Beverly Hills, I don't even like her, but she was wearing a shirt the other day that said something like, every woman should be a feminist, or everyone should be a feminist. There was a couple of references that weren't specifically about Trump, but you could just kind of tell that they didn't like Trump and whatever his quote unquote values are. So the same thing, I also like the other spin-off show, which is Vanderpump Rules. And, you know, I mean, these young people who are in their 20s and 30s are same thing. I'm noticing little things in those shows that are telling me that they're aware. It just might be a throwaway comment. But, you know, when I watch these shows, I just cover my eyes and think, oh my God, we're fucking doomed. But, you know, I'm starting to realize that, no, they're actually kind of, some of these people are paying attention and, and they're upset about what's happening. So I do think that they're going to, I think they're going to vote. You know, we can only hope.
we can only hope. I gotta tell you something. Right. You know, I live in Oakland, as you know, and as I've said many times here on the show, we're just as blue can be. You know what I mean? And I love it.
Yeah.
But I do, I belong to a gym that's through the tunnel, which is, you know, a lot less diverse. It's a beautiful place to live. It's a nice place to raise your kids. If, you know, it's very homogenous though.
Yeah.
And I walked into just a little tiny cafe yesterday after my workout to grab some coffee and a donut. And, and they had a sign in the window for the Women's March on January 20th. Wow. And that's real.
Yeah.
And my coach who grew up in the Danville area went to the Women's March in Walnut Creek and she said there were over 10,000 people.
Wow.
That gives me a tremendous amount of hope.
Yeah.
Because what it's showing me is there are people who, regardless of their political affiliation, there's a right and wrong, right? There's the Dreamers deserve to have citizenship, okay? Because they are contributing members of society. And they're the best of the best, you know, when we're talking about Americans.
Yeah.
And that's like, there's a right and there's a wrong side to be on where that, you know, of that argument, right? There's racism and then there's not racism.
Right.
Which side do you want to be on? And so that makes me happy, and I think that transfers to, well, I might be a registered Republican, but that doesn't mean I'm voting for this
right.
This piece of shit who sides with Russia over contributing members of our society. You know, when I'm talking about Dreamers,
yeah,
like I think that's starting to happen. So that makes me really happy.
Yeah, I think there are some promising signs. And you're right. The march is another huge, 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 huge piece of proof that people are paying attention. And this is not your typical, I don't know, anything administration. It's just not. And people know it. Mm-hmm. So I do have hope that that we're going to see a high turnout and get things changed around.
All right. Okay. I know. I'm just really loud. You know, this has become my passion. I've decided, like, I'm super committed to just making sure that we go blue this year because our humanity depends on it.
Yes.
It really does.
It absolutely does. And there's a lot of things that are going to have to be changed, which actually we're going to talk about in our next segment, which is End Another Thing. So I'm going to, you know, interrupt for a little commercial break here and then we're going to switch over. So basically,
oh my God,
I know.
Bob, I just, thank you. Thank you.
Everybody can become a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/startmeup. You can do anything. $1 a month, $5 a month gets you into End Another Thing, which is our segment that comes up next. Or you can just support our show with any dollar amount you wish, and we hope that you do. So, there you go. And Born to Run. I mean, I had to put that on, you know.
Halloween.